Welcome to Flipper Talks, a family law podcast. We are Flipper, the Family Law Practitioners Association of Queensland. Family law is a wonderfully rewarding career, but is not without its challenges. Join us as we explore the issues that impact on the practice and well-being of family law practitioners. We hope our episodes will not only inform and inspire you, but encourage you to reach your potential. Enjoy this episode.
Today on Flipper Talks, a family law podcast, I'm delighted to welcome Margie, who many of you may remember as Her Honour, Judge Cassidy. Margie began her distinguished career as a barrister before moving to the bench in 2005, first serving as a state magistrate and then joining the Federal Magistrates Court, as it was then known, in December 2007. After 15 years of dedicated service, she stepped away from the bench in December 2022. Now she's embarked on an exciting new chapter as a mediator and arbitrator. Welcome, Margie. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
But if I can take you back to the beginning of your career, I see that you have a background in science and an honours degree at that. What steered you towards law instead of continuing in the scientific field?
Look, I loved that work. I really enjoyed it. I was doing research into the transplantation across a major histocompatibility barrier of rat parathyroid. Now, who would you know, not want to stay with that? But actually, it did have a basis for something that might have ultimately helped cure diabetes. That was what they were looking at. But the trouble is, it was grant-based. And so you had to apply for NH and MRC grants every year in those days. I think it might be better now. They might give you 3 years or 5 years. But I had two young children that I was supporting, and it was just really difficult to be constantly applying for your job, basically, and competing in a world where, you know, they just didn't fund science the way they should, I think. It's where a lot of answers come from. And it's never been funded to the extent that I think it should be. So I decided to move into a more stable career. Yeah, so that's pretty much what it was.
And that brought you into law, which is very lucky for us. You were called to the bar in 1993. What was it like for a woman entering the legal profession at that time?
Well, look, there were lots of, well, quite a few women who were solicitors, but when I went to the bar, I was the only female on my floor. There weren't terribly many female barristers. Can I say, look, I was very well supported by my colleagues. I make no criticism of them. In fact, they were fantastic and really stepped out of their way to help in every respect. And that collegiate nature that they talk about was so obvious for me. And I'm eternally grateful to them. But now my floor on ends of court, there's more girls than boys, so it's really good.
Lovely to see the turn of the times.
Yeah.
You have an extensive knowledge of family law system and have, in my experience before your retirement as a judge and also now as a mediator, a very practical and empathetic approach to family law. How did you find yourself in family law?
Oh, look, as you do when you go to the bar, like, you really have this idea of what you're going to do, because I'd been teaching tax and company law at Griffith University to accountants, and it was in the quote-unquote time when they were doing the simplification of the family law, of the, I think it was the Corporations Act. Well, it wasn't very simplified, can I say.
But it never is.
But I was really on top of it because I was teaching it, and I thought, oh, you know, when I go to the bar, I'll be able to be of some use in tax and company. And they always said at the bar practice course, just stay in chambers in the evening because you'll get a call, you'll be briefed for the next morning. That's exactly what happened. And it was family law, and it was from Bain Gastine, and they then continued to brief me. And actually, their tax and company were quite useful in family law, because there's quite a lot of structures in family law that are complex and really need to be carefully navigated. And I mean, I saw as a judge sometimes people ripping money out of companies, and I'm going, yeah, I know it's your company, but you can't do that sort of thing. So it was really just sitting and getting the brief. And then once you get the one or two, and someone on the other side thinks that you've at least been prepared and got somewhere near the right mark, they'll give you some work the next time. So it just grew from there. So that's pretty much how all of the work came to me, yeah.
And did you find, this is without notice question, but
that's all right.
Did you find that insofar as family law, once you were getting there, that there was more a parenting or a property kind of cases that you were getting?
Oh, probably parenting. I mean, the majority of the work in the court is parenting work. The reason for that is unless someone's got a bit of a problem, they settle their property matters. I mean, the ones that actually go to trial, there's usually an aspect of one or other of the people that has a personality issue that just says, I'd rather cut off my nose to spite my face than to settle with this person. Or, they're always a bit quirky. Or sometimes they're just a difficult question legally and you need an answer from a court. But on the whole, people settled property matters.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was the majority of work with children's matters, yeah. And I loved doing ICL matters. I really enjoyed working with children, yeah.
And I'm sure that many of the practitioners would have appreciated having you as an ICL barrister as well.
Oh, I hope so, yeah. I think we did some useful things. You wonder sometimes, don't you?
You do. You spent nearly 12 years at the bar. Are there any cases, and maybe an ICL case, that stands out to you or particular people?
Well, actually, I did think about this on the weekend because there are so many. Anyone that says law is dull has never sat in the back of a family law court, really, because I've chosen a few. The first one wasn't in our jurisdiction. It was in the Supreme Court, and it was a parents patriae matter. I acted for an Aboriginal woman who'd had her little baby taken from her because she'd abused the little tiny baby, and I saw pictures of the physical harm, and it was pretty horrible. She then had it was postpartum depression, and she then had another little girl to the same father, and it was 5 years later, and the department were wanting to give the five-year-old back to her, but the foster mother was just holding on for literally her life. You know, she went through every form of jurisdiction she could, and the ultimate one is called the Parents Patriae Jurisdiction in the Supreme Court. And they ultimately have jurisdiction over children in a most unusual way. So here I am looking up what Parents Patriae means, as you could imagine, when I first got briefed in the matter. So we went for 12 days in this trial. And one of the things that's interesting about it was she hadn't ever been charged with the assault of the child. And so I spoke to a family lawyer, a friend of mine who I'm very fond of. I won't name him. He became a judge, as did the other person I spoke to. He just said, tell him everything about the abuse, you know, just say it. And the other one, who was a criminal lawyer, a silk, said, just tell her to take, you know, to say, I'm, you know, not able to answer this question on the basis it might incriminate me. So I'm going, oh, what am I going to do? So, but that act doesn't have, the Evidence Act in this Supreme Court doesn't have the protection of being able to get a certificate.
Okay, I've seen a few of those being issued
over
my career. And actually now I think back, it was one of my matters I had in front of you, Margie, where I had to call one for my client.
Yeah. Well, I think they're a useful thing for a court to be able to understand it and really drill down into the reality of the situation. But they're not available. And so I thought, oh, I'm just not going to take a chance on it. So I got every time the question was asked, I stood up and the judge gave her the warning, and I wrote a little card out for her to say, I'm not able to answer this on the basis it might incriminate me. She just had that in front of her. And so anyhow, we went for 12 days and we were 100% successful. We got the little girl back, but it was just such a stressful matter because it was on the front page of the Courier Mail every day. And I tried it very hard to get it actually as a closed court, because it was in the Supreme Court. And the morning I turned up to the trial, standing at the other end of the bar table, is the most senior silk in Queensland, ready to argue for the Courier Mail to have an open court. This little black duck's going, heavens to Murgatroyd, you know. I wasn't. They didn't warn me, which I thought was outrageous. So anyhow, we ran that argument. I lost, and so it was spilling out onto the front page of the Courier Mail every day. And I just decided after the first day I just wasn't going to read it. And so that's how I got through it. So that was one. The second one was a property matter, and I'll only do two because I've been talking for too long on that one.
Oh, no, please, do them all. We love hearing.
The second one was a property matter just after superannuation became property. And Gary Cowper was the solicitor. I'm sure I can say his name. He's one of my favourite solicitors. He used to do a lot of work with him, ICL work. Anyhow, it was a property matter, and the man was a very bad man, very bad man. I mean, to give an example, he had gone through the house with an axe and just smashed all of the furniture and the whole house. It was completely ruined, you know, that attitude. Anyhow, we ran a contravention. He failed to appear, so we got an arrest warrant for him. And then they arrested him, and he was downstairs in the cells. Have you ever been down there?
I have once for a client. It's intimidating.
So,
Gary, and cold.
Cold. We go down there and we ask him if he wants to give the money back, and he says no. So we go upstairs, and it was Justice Jordan. And so we were running the contravention. It was a simple lot of questions that I had. Firstly, you had $250,000 in superannuation. Yes. You withdrew it on this date? Yes. Where is it now? And no answer. So I asked the judge to ask him to answer the question, and he refused to answer the question. So the judge adjourned for lunch and put him downstairs in the cells, and then came back at 2:15 and asked him to answer the question. Finally, he did answer the question. It was in a caravan at Logan. So I thought, oh, what am I going to do? So I said to the judge, because the federal police were still in the back of the court. In those days, people weren't as busy, you know, that the federal police wouldn't go till they were excused by the judge. That's still the case, but you tend now to excuse them the minute they walk in. So I said to the judge, Your Honour, I'll ask you to make the order that he transfers it to my solicitor, but that he not be released from custody until the transfer occurs. So off Gary Cowper goes. I go home to have a glass of Chardonnay. Gary drives after the police down to the caravan at Logan. The man gets the money out, gives it to Gary. The police say, well, we're off to play tennis, see you later. And Gary, you know, nervously gets into the car and thinks, I've got $250,000 in cash and I can't take it to the bank tonight to put into my trust account. So he took it to his office and he rang me and he said, it's all very well for you, Mark. She said, I was watching my rear vision mirror the whole way back to the office waiting for this man to come with an axe and collect the $250,000. So
I'm sure Gary didn't have a very good sleep that night until we got to the bank in the morning.
Yeah, so that was that one. And just as an ICL, I just felt that it was a really interesting, you know, to be able to play that role of amicus curiae and just ask any sort of question that would give some light to the matters. And I can remember asking this man about, oh, he got a drink driving charge one night. And I just said, oh, look, you know, you haven't really got any history of alcohol or anything? He said, no. He said, no, that night, he said, I found out my father was charged with 80 counts of interfering with a child. This is the first we heard of it, was in front of Justice Warning. And so I was able to ask him some questions about that. But, like, you know, you really can explore, because the answer is what it is. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be constrained like you can when you're acting for a party. So I think it's a great privilege to act in that role, and it's such an important role for children.
Again, another question without notice, but just
how many of these have you got?
Oh, it's just they're opening up, because I know there is a few practitioners that find the burden of being an ICL quite a lot. And so I'm interested to kind of hear your insights insofar as the importance of it to share for people to be looking at doing the training and provide such an invaluable service for parties.
It's very poorly paid, and, you know, I used to just limit myself to a couple a month, you know, three a month or something. Because, you know, you just really, it's unfortunate that the legal aid system hasn't got sufficient funds to pay even what, I mean, I think it's almost the same as when I was doing it, what they're paying them. But it's just, what I would really like to see, I'll say this that now that I've got a place to say it, years ago they didn't do formal training. You could just become an ICL with experience. And some of my solicitors' colleagues that were really very experienced just did two or three a year just to give back to the system. And it didn't matter from my point of view. I could ring them and say, can you subpoena, blah, 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 blah. They'd just go and do it. And it was almost as if they did it pro bono. And I would like to see that coming back where, you know, all of those three said, I'm not going to do the accreditation. I haven't got time to do that. But, you know, there's some very experienced solicitors that I'd just love to see them be able to get a little opportunity to do two or three with an accreditation that doesn't involve as much training, because they don't really need it, in my view. You know, they've been doing this work forever and they know how to go and find out where the bodies lie. And so I just would like to think that there could be a two-stream accreditation, and those really very experienced solicitors who don't do it because it's financially really not viable just did one.
Time too, I think, is probably a thing that comes with out of the training.
Of course, that's right. Mm. But, you know, you can think of any number of them that could do it with their eyes closed and just do two or three a year, because it is so, so important. I can't tell you how important it is as a judge sitting on the bench. You know, that work that they put in to give us the information that helps us hopefully get it right it's invaluable. Yeah. But what that's worth. I'd be interested to hear what people think about that, because I know they stopped doing it because that accreditation came in before I went to the bench, so it probably came in about 18 years ago. I can't remember now. Yeah. Mm.
Something for Flipper to think about.
Oh, good. Come on, all you people that have been out there doing this work for a long time, just give us a little bit.
Yeah. So you were appointed as a magistrate in the Queensland Magistrates Court in 2005 and then as a judge to the Federal Magistrates Court, as it was then known, in 2007. How did you know the move from the State Magistrates Court to the Federal Magistrates Court was the right move for you?
Look, I had come from family law. As I said, when I started at the bar, it just literally came and just kept going, and I was almost exclusively, within 12 months, I was just in the family law jurisdiction all the time. And then when I got approached to do the magistrate's job, I took it because my friend Barb Tynan, who was a barrister who'd been wonderfully helpful and supportive for me when I went to the bar, was a magistrate. And so she'd enjoyed the transition. But when I was approached by Justice Bowman asked me if I would be interested, and I said yes. And then when the attorney rang, it was about 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. I was in Townsville trying to find somewhere for this poor Indigenous woman to spend the weekend other than in the watch house. And I got every help service in Townsville. She was a really bad alcoholic. She used to get very cranky when she drank. I'll call her Mrs. K. And I'd say, Mrs. K, you know, like, I don't want to put you in the watch house, but, you know, you've got to behave yourself. And then finally I got a daughter to come in. I said, please take her for the weekend, you know. She said, oh, she'll misbehave. I said, if she does, she can come straight back. And then the attorney rang and said, would I say interested? I said yes immediately. But I was going home. I was going to all of the people that I'd worked with for years, and I – I'm really pleased that I went back there. Yeah.
So in those times in the career, and perhaps this follows from your story you've just shared, Margie, where you had a difficult day, either an unfavourable bad outcome as a barrister, or you had to make a decision on one of those impossible cases while on the bench, what motivated you to come back day to day to family law?
Oh, look, I just think both those jurisdictions are the really, for want of a better expression, the bottom line of law. Like almost everyone in Australia has had some contact with either the magistrate's court or the family law jurisdiction in both, you know, courts. And so I just think it's an important part of serving Australia. I mean, the Supreme and the District Court have their places, as does the High Court, but this is where you're really in touch with actually serving an important role across a really broad range of people. And I mean, imagine if you didn't have those jurisdictions, you know, especially the family law one, not to be able to resolve those children's matters and those property matters. I mean, there'd just be chaos in so many of those people. Yeah.
In preparing for this interview, I'm reminded of the story you very generously shared at your Flipper retirement party regarding an interim hearing where, in a property matter, you sought orders for a court to hold a Canadian adult's passport, but were quickly reminded that there might be a jurisdictional issue there. I thank you for sharing that. This is important for senior members of the profession to share stories of their shortcomings to help others in those moments. Whilst humorous, I imagine the time you weren't laughing, and I wonder if you have any advice to share with the profession as how to overcome those stomach-churning feelings when you've made an error.
Sure. You'll be pleased to know, I thought as soon as Justice Lindemeyer heard that I'd won that prize for the, you know, Flipper, that he would ring and say, take it away from her immediately. She's a mad woman that doesn't understand that, you know, a Canadian passport belongs to the Canadian government and there's no way that I could hold it in the safe custody of the court. But fortunately, he didn't do that, so I've been able to hold on to it for the entire 2 years, and it's been a great privilege to have it. But look, and in that case, I just straight away said, oh, Your Honour, I don't press that application, because I immediately realised, and it just hadn't occurred to me, because we're so used to when people, you know, try and leave the country, that, you know, you get the injunction, you put the airport watch in and you take their passport. It's just automatic. But I just think what you do is you go on the front foot. I mean, the wrong thing then would have been to argue with that judge. I mean, anyone that did that would just be an idiot. And luckily I was a bit careless and a bit thoughtless and not thinking about that, but I wasn't an idiot, so I immediately withdrew it. And look, I just think going on to the front foot is always the right way to do it. You just have to go in. Even if you've made a mistake and you've only found out afterwards, I think you've got to relist. I think you've got to put it back before the judge. And I can remember as a barrister doing one, this little girl, she was a dear little, like a little tiny doll person from the Philippines with a very horrible, horrible husband and a tiny little baby girl that was just like a sweetest little thing. Anyhow, she I failed to tell us that she'd already been married in the Philippines. Then she got married here, which was, of course, a very serious problem for me because she was in a bigamous relationship. And I said to the solicitor, we're going to have to, you know, put that before the court. We're going to have to get a certificate. We're going to have to protect her. But we can't not, because she'd lied on oath. Mm-hmm. And so, anyhow, we've sorted it all out. And the thing is, the way we did it, it really took the wind out of their sails in terms of cross-examination, because we'd already fixed it up. And so they weren't hitting her with it in cross-examination at the trial. And so often, if it's a mistake the client's made, or a failure to tell the truth, I suppose it'd be one of a better word, that, you know, you're better off fixing it. And so, yeah, I mean, sometimes you have to withdraw. You can't continue to act if they, for example, refuse to rectify something. But I just, going on the front foot's always the best way to fix those things. And having Tic Tacs in your little pocket so that when your mouth gets incredibly dry, you just put a Tic Tac in your mouth.
Well, I might have to do a shop for some before next time I've been caught. So in your total of 17 years at the bench, what's been some of the most rewarding and challenging aspects of your career as a judge? Because we've just shared some of those rewards as at the bar, but what about at the bench?
When I was a magistrate, they had three hardship positions that you could take, and if you took one of those, they guaranteed you could come back to Brisbane after 2 years. So I put my hand up for the Northern Relieving Magistrate. It was a glorious job. I was hoping they'd give me a badge. And it meant that you just flew around endlessly up in the north, going from one place to the other. But I did an enormous amount of work in the Cape, and I met some fabulous people in the Indigenous communities, and I was fortunate to go to some of their art centres, and I've just got some beautiful carvings from Arakoon and some wonderful paintings from some of the people up at Lockhart. You know, they were the young, they were fantastic artists. I mean, they're in the Biennale in Venice. They're in the French gallery, I forget what it's called. And they used to come into my court quite regularly too. So, you know, they had this rich tapestry of their lives. But it was so fabulous to see some of their work up there in person, and to meet some of the people was, you know, I mean, there was horrible crime up there and a lot of sadness. But there was a lot of wonderful people too that really looked after their children. And so there were two aeroplane stories. One was I had a really bad head cold, and the pilot, because we were in little light planes, said, you could burst your eardrums if we fly high, so we'll fly low. So we flew at 1,000 feet all the way from Kawanyama, which is at the bottom of the Gulf of Carpentaria, right up to Bamaga at the top at 1,000 feet. And, you know, we saw all the, like, you could see the animals in the water and the, and then we landed at Kawanyama over the crocodile farm. You could see all the crocodiles. That was kind of hair-raising. And then when we were coming back, he said to me, I'll get a clearance to fly over the Barron Falls. And so literally I could have dropped a fishing line out of the aeroplane to see over the falls. And just to see that country that, you know, as I did, both, you know, being on those. And when we were out of, Kadumba, there's this cloud that's like a rolling cloud, and all the little light aircraft were there to watch it. We were the only ones that could surf it because we were flying out of an area that other people aren't allowed to fly in. So we surfed this, it's called a morning glory cloud. Well, I wonder how many other people have surfed the morning glory cloud.
A handful, I think.
And there's one more story, which was we were trying to land at Lockhart. And do you remember that really horrible crash at Lockhart?
Yes.
Yeah. Anyhow. So I'm sitting there thinking, now pilots know what they're doing, it's not my job. So we tried to land once, no, took off. The wind was too much coming. Tried to land the second way, there was something else wrong. Third time around, because you go out over the water and then come back in, and so you're trying to land from each end of the aircraft strip. The third time around, I thought, oh, this is going to, I'm going to be dead before the day's out. And then he said, I don't think I can land. I thought, well, thank goodness you've realised that. He said, do you want to go back to Cairns or do you want to go to Weipa? And I said, we'll go to Weipa. So we went back to Weipa, and he said, do you want to try again? And I said, not today. but it was a wonderful to see all of those places, and it was great. And, you know, the chances of being able to do some really interesting things in the family law has been exciting too. But the two that were really, that stood out, one of them, it's another story against myself, was that day that I was the only judge left in the building at 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. That's not saying that happens very often, but just this Friday afternoon, I was the only judge left there, and they said, we've got an urgent ex parte injunction against the Commonwealth to stop a little baby boy who's born here from being taken back to Manus or one of the islands. I thought, ex parte injunction against the Commonwealth. Why would I do that? I mean, they're supposed to be a model litigant. So I ran upstairs. I said to the librarian, I know it's Friday afternoon, I know it's 4 o'clock, but could you just stay? Could you just look for ex parte injunctions against a Commonwealth government? I then ran down to the federal court and the registrar and said, I don't know what I'll need. I just don't know what I'll need, but you've got to stay. You've got to stay. Because I'd done no immigration work. And so I got the act and I thought, oh, it's a big act. And I looked at the section that they'd cited. And so I got into the courtroom and I said to the counsel, it was a solicitor, Murray Watts, and they were doing it pro bono from one of the big, Shine Roach, or one, I can't remember which firm he was with. I said, oh, I'm very concerned to be injuncting the Commonwealth without hearing from them. He said, well, Your Honour, last time we put them on notice that the affidavit said, you know, the plane had taken off. Now, I'm not suggesting that they knew and sent the plane off, but that was the suggestion in the affidavit. So anyhow, we found some poor hapless person in Canberra at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And he said, I said, oh, look, I'm a bit worried about this. Can you give an undertaking? And so he said he could. And I said, now, you've got the authority to give that undertaking? Because, you know, you just
don't know who was on the other line.
And he said, yes. So I said to Lauren, we'll actually, put the undertaking at the beginning of the order given by this particular person, and we'll still put the airport watch in because I just didn't know, you know, if that was right and the person had fled the jurisdiction. But oh, it was so draining.
I'm sure a glass of Chardonnay was waiting for you at home on Friday.
Yeah, so that was one of them. And oh, there was some, you know, you met some really crazy litigants. But one of the good things, I know there's a good system in place now and I'm not being critical of it. One of the good things about actually having a matter from start to finish, you got to know the crazies and they got to know you. And by the time you did the trial, they were really comfortable to be crazy in their own way and you knew exactly what they were going to do. So it was almost easier than having them turn up on the, you know, first day of trial and be quite difficult. You learnt to manage them. That I thought that was an advantage. But one of the ones that gave me a little bit of a fright was this gentleman who was a, you know, the sovereign citizen, and it was during COVID. And so we must have opened the court again, but it was still COVID-ish. And anyhow, he handed up an affidavit and I said, what's that? Each page he'd stamped with blood. His fingerprint. So I just picked it up and asked Mr. Associate for one of those plastic folders and I popped it into it and gave it back to him and said, I think I'll get you to file that electronically. There's millions of stories, but I think that's enough for now.
For judges, the decision of retiring from the bench is often based on reaching expiry of their term of appointment. In the FCFCOA, attaining a certain age.
It's which, 70.
Oh, I was being kind, which is what occurred for you, Margie. How did you feel about hanging up your judicial robes in 2022?
Oh, look, I think it's good to make room for new people and that's an important part of moving on and knowing when it's time to go. One of the things that I think I could have perhaps been useful for another few years in a way, but anyhow, that's what it is and the Constitution says that. But I really think it's a pity. In the state courts, they can go part-time and I think it's like dropping off the edge of a cliff, going from full-time to nothing. And I really like doing that work. So, I'm pleased that I could find some other part-time work rather than just going straight into sort of, you know, digging gardens and making cakes, of which I'm not good at either.
And following your retirement from the bench, you're now assisting clients in resolving disputes as a mediator. Former judges have commented the challenges of transitioning from litigation to mediation. How have you found the shift in roles?
Oh, look, I mean, you just want to tell them the answer. That's always a problem. I realised that after the first one. Mark, just, you know, pull your head in. But it is a different role, but it's not. It reminds me of back at the bar where you're bringing people along with you and supporting them to get to an answer. And I've really enjoyed that because you can be much more engaged with the party than you can be on the bench. You've got to really be seen to be neutral on the bench, and you're not, and you can't really express those, what's it, sometimes an appropriate sympathy or empathy or, you know, understanding of what they're going through. And I found that to be one of the things I've liked about the mediation, to be able to engage with the client again, you know, and to hold back on what I think the answer is and to help them get to it rather than telling them what it is, which is what I used to do.
Preparing for a mediation can have a significant role in helping the matter resolve. Is there any other things you could share on how a lawyer or their client can prepare to be in the right headspace when walking into a mediation?
Look, I think the best thing to do is have your client understand the range that a court's likely to award the answer, you know, because sadly I've seen clients come in that really had an expectation that was outside what a court was likely to, you know, order. And, I mean, it's sadly some of the people perhaps less experienced who are just taking instructions and feel as if they've got to be true to their client's instructions. And, of course, that's not their role. They've done 4 years at university and they're being paid quite a significant amount of money by the client to get advice. And sometimes I used to say, you put the blood on the floor in my chambers, not in the courtroom. And I think that's right. You really tell them, you know, give them a lower end of the range expectation when they're going to court, and they'll often come away a little bit better off than they thought they would be. And I think that's important at a mediation, to give them a range and for them to understand that that's where the negotiation should occur, that it's not. And of course they're going to be less happy when they walk out, because they're going to be some percentage off, less well off than they were when they walked in. And I just think having every document prepared and every aspect of the case, so you really know where you're going and what, you know, what to expect, is important. And having your client prepared for it. And I mean, I don't know what to do when you've got a client that just won't take your advice, but usually you see them in their mediations and they've had 4 solicitors and you go, okay, I know what to expect today.
It's a bit of a giveaway.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, this is what I've been told, but I don't want to, you know, I earned all the money, it's mine. You know, that sort of attitude. Well, not quite. No. They're three little babies, the triplets, that, you know, with a mum that doesn't work. Yeah.
Sounds like that might have been a mediation you had recently, Mark.
No, I just made that up. I wouldn't like anyone to think I was sharing secrets of a confidential mediation.
Moving on to assisting the young professionals coming through, there's been a lot of change in the way we do law, and you would have seen over your career that has happened. But some of the core skills will never change, such as the importance of, as we just shared, preparation, preparation, preparation.
Oh, absolutely.
What advice would you give young professionals entering into family law?
Well, I mean, I think it's been a bit unfortunate that people haven't been able to sit in the back of the court as much as they used to. And I know there's a lot of advantages to doing everything online and or doing it at specific times, so that you're not there all day waiting for your matter to come on. But the advantages of being there all day waiting for the matter to come on were you often settled it, but you could sit in the back of the court and watch people doing their advocacy. And I learnt so much from sitting, watching, and even at the bar table, someone cross-examining, I'd go, gee, that was a good idea, you know. And so you just over and over. In fact, one of the best questions I ever saw, and I was a barrister who, it was alleged that this man had, it wasn't me, I wish I could say it was me, I think $200,000 at the start of the relationship in a cupboard. And so the counsellor asked, in what denominations was it? And you could tell the client was a bit flummoxed by that. And then he said, and how big was the parcel? What size was it? You know, well, I've never seen $200,000 in cash, so I don't know whether it's the size of a lump of butter or, you know, a great big, you know, cardboard box of something, you know. So just little things that you see, you learn from watching. Now, I guess that's hard when you can't do it on the client's time or on work's time, but, gee, it's invaluable to just see that. And also, I just can't can't overemphasize the importance of actually knowing what you're asking for and having the statutory references and authorities, because, you know, people just go in and ask for something and they just haven't thought whether the court's got jurisdiction to do it. And I used to take over a little trolley with every case that was relevant and the statutes, which were in loose leaf at the time. It didn't matter how many times I'd been to the courtroom, that I took that every time. And I know now you can take it digitally, but sometimes people don't take it. In fact, I don't think they even know what they're asking for in terms of the statutory references and authorities. And they just know that people have asked for it in the past. But just knowing, I used to, when I wrote out my submissions in the morning, every morning I did written submissions when I was going to the court, I'd check jurisdiction. And just write out, what are the elements? What do I need to prove to get what I want today? And just going through it and doing it as a written submission, whether they ask for it or not, it focuses your mind. Because I can remember doing one 4 o'clock one morning in the Supreme Court, and it was a Benjamin order for someone in a will. And he was a young railway worker. He'd only died at 32, so his parents were dead, he had no siblings. And so in the letters of administration, these are the people that take. And I just was realising, and in those days we used to, the solicitor had served, had looked up phone books, they'd looked up electoral rolls, it was all search, you know, in the old-fashioned way. And I actually thought, you know, his grandmother could still be alive. And it was just doing it that morning. Mm. So I went to the court, asked for it to be stood down so that we could search for her, and then we got it the next time we went back. But just when you're actually writing it down and searching through to work out what you need, it's sometimes a little gap will show up. But other than that, I think just being well prepared is the answer, isn't it?
It is. Do you have any advice for juniors as to how they can hone their advocacy skills besides the opportunity to sit in the back of the courtroom when they do arise?
Well, see, I think Flipper have been doing some fantastic work with that. And, you know, going in and doing those Flipper workshops, I was asked to sit in on one last year, and it was really well done because very kindly the court had offered to support it with Judicial Registrar Best I was in front of. And I know it's not the same as a real court, but I think that's a good way of doing it. And just knowing the brief so backwards and forwards that you're really not stressed, and do written submissions so that you're on top of it. Now, so when you're asked questions, you can answer them without thinking. You know, it's when you get stuck with being caught out that it becomes more stressful.
Yes. Yeah. And as a final word, as a final word of wisdom for our listeners, reflecting on your career, is there any piece of advice you wish you had received early on?
I thought about this on the weekend, and you know, what I think it is, as a barrister and as a judge, I always thought, I just have to do this, I can't not do this, I've got to do this today, even if I felt sick. And one of the things I missed, and I really am sorry I missed, was some of my friends' parents' funerals, and I thought, I just can't go to that. I'd write a note or send some flowers. And you know what? I think I should have stood down. I really think that I could have said to the people as a judge, look, could you come at 9 and do you mind sitting till 5 tomorrow? I've just got to be away for 3 hours. And they probably would have said yes. And also, I think as counsel, if you're in a trial and you want to do that, I think you should ask the court, because noting those special things is part of life, you know. And I really am sorry I didn't do that as often as I should have. I just thought, oh, you've got to be in the courtroom at these times, you know. And, you know, taking more time for yourself, just not kind of just spending it all doing that stuff, you know. I used to work at most Sundays, and really it's more fun things to do on Sundays.
Yes, like lovely lunches with your friends that you were sharing before we started.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Margie. I really appreciate your time today.
Oh, thank you for asking me.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Flipper Talks, a family law podcast. We hope you enjoyed the podcast today. We confirm that the information we discussed today was just that, information for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is not specific advice. If something discussed has you considering whether you should take steps, it is important to make sure you get professional advice about your unique situation before you proceed, whether that be legal, financial, accounting, medical, or other advice. Please reach out to Flipper if there's another topic you'd like explored, and if you know someone who might benefit from the show, remember to tell them about it. Thank you for listening.